Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
A search for the truth behind an international drug smuggling plot.
How are we going to unravel this all?
From the BBC World Service, this is World of Secrets, Season 5, Finding Mr. Fox. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, we'll be in Chad to investigate whether or not President Mahamat Idriss Deby can make good on a threat to the Islamist group Boko Haram that killed more than 40 of his soldiers. From the United States, a Congolese asylum seeker has a message for the presidential hopefuls Kamala Harris and Donald Trump.
If they give us condition that we will be safe here, you will go to school, you will get the work in order to pay your bills. That is all. That is my prayer. But when we see the speech, when you see how they try to, you know, it hurt me. It hurt us. We are in fear. We don't know where to go.
And why are Somalis risking social cohesion and their bank balances in a game on a social media platform?
All the money I received, I'm not spending for myself, for my family, or for my school. I'm just spending on TikTok. To me, personally, it's kind of like just to support the people where I was from.
It's Wednesday, the 30th of October. First, we go to Chad. N'Djamena has announced 3 days of mourning following the killing of more than 40 soldiers in an attack by Boko Haram. Now, we usually talk about the Islamist movement in the context of attacks in northeastern Nigeria, but it has long been a menace to the people in neighboring countries as well. Chad is one of them. So is Cameroon, Niger, and Mali. We'll explore how these countries are fighting the insurgency together in a moment. But let's hear first from the Chadian President Mahamat Idriss Deby, promising the wrath of his army to avenge the deaths of the soldiers in an attack on a military base this past weekend.
There has been fighting. Thanks to our brave defense and security forces, the situation is now under control. Unfortunately, we have many martyrs and casualties too. We're going to hunt down every last one of the attackers. We're going to hunt them down wherever they go. We're going to follow them. We're going to pursue them. We're going to eliminate them one by one. In a few days' time, they will see the thunderbolts of the Chadian National Army.
Chadian President Mahamat Idriss Deby's army had been fighting the Boko Haram insurgency as part of a multinational force comprising the armies of countries around Lake Chad and parts of the Sahel. Remaji Hoinati is a senior researcher for Central Africa and the Lake Chad Basin at the Institute of Security Studies. Give us an idea of where in Chad this attack happened.
The attack happened in the province of the Lac. That is one of the two Chadian provinces that are directly impacted by Boko Haram, and precisely in a locality called Barkaram, that is actually close to the Niger border, around 10 kilometers separated from Niger.
Did it come as a surprise?
For sure, it came actually as a surprise, because since this last year, we haven't witnessed this kind of strong attack on a Chadian military post.
Why was it a surprise, though, and why was the military base targeted? Surely the multinational joint task force, which Chad is part of, would have perhaps been on the alert for attacks like these, or did they relax their guard a little bit, given that there hadn't been attacks for a while?
It's very difficult, you know, remaining on a full alert against such kind of attacks. And when you look at the modus operandi and the period of the attack, it was like actually at night, so under dark. Meaning that in this kind of fight against a group like Boko Haram, that can very easily split in very small groups and then gather. Looking also at the context of the Lake Chad, meaning a lot of islands, a lot of swamps, etc. You know, whatever the kind of vigilance that would be developed mean the armies are always, you know, vulnerable to those kind of attacks.
So Boko Haram conducted the attack. We hear quite a lot about the group in northern Nigeria, but how strong is their presence in Chad and in neighboring countries?
Let us recall the fact that since 2014, Boko Haram gained a kind of regional footprint, with Nigeria remaining the hotspot of the conflict. But since that time, the group have been very present in the other countries. Compared to other countries in the region, Chad has actually shown a kind of more capability or resilience in terms of resisting Boko Haram. Meaning that concretely, there have not been, you know, a kind of permanent camps of Boko Haram on the Chadian territory. But the fact that this group, as I say, is very mobile and that they also master very well the context, the physical context of the Lake Chad, they can very easily move across the countries, seen as the borders remain also very porous, they are underwater. They have this capability investing all of the countries at the same time.
Chad is part of a multinational joint task force, the MNJTF. Nigeria, Niger, Cameroon and Benin are part of the force. How successful has this task force been in cutting down the attacks and fighting Boko Haram?
I think it's a kind of double bind reality, you know. Since the setting of the MNJTF, it's more than one decade. And Boko Haram being still on the ground and able of committing those kind of attacks means that whatever the success that have been observed, the group remain very resilient and also very challenging to the MNJTF. But what we could say is that these last months there have been a strong transnational operation launched by the MNJTF, that is the Operation Lake Sanity 2. And this operation actually targeted Boko Haram's hideouts on the islands, on the swamps, but also in some forest. So in a way, this operation weakened Boko Haram in terms of military capability, but also in terms of troops. So witnessing this kind of attack just 3 months or 2 months after the end of the Operation Lake Sanity means that, you know, all that actually is done on the ground by the MNJTF, although successful at some point, remain not enough, you know, really curtailing the group and weakening it to a level that it won't represent any more danger for communities and the armies.
What are the failures or shortcomings of the joint force?
You know, there is something that we absolutely, when talking about this fight and its outcomes, there's something that we need to nuance. We are facing a kind of asymmetric warfare. The enemy actually sits within the communities. And then this is the biggest difficulty, how to separate the enemy from the communities. The very context is very specific. It's a context mainly on water. It's a context mainly on islands. It's a context mainly in swamps, etc. So this poses the adaptability of the means that the different armies and the MNJTF actually have in hand to fight them. And for me, this is the biggest challenge, you know, being able, having the adapted equipment and material to fight an enemy that can act very easily, you know, disappear on the islands and around the swamps. This is a big challenge.
Now, Chad's President Mahamat Idriss Deby said that in a few days' time, they will see the thunderbolts of the Chadian National Army. Can the Chadian Army send thunderbolts the way of Boko Haram and destroy them, uproot them? Or is this a sort of confidence-boosting measure?
I would start by the last. I mean, in such situation as the head of the army, I mean, there was a need of this kind of strong discourses, this kind of strong narrative to boost the mental of the troops, but also to boost the confidence of the communities in the army. But then there is a reality on the ground. And the reality on the ground is that, you know, at the time that the army would launch those operations, where would be, you know, the people that actually attack those places in Barakaram? This is a question. I think that we should nuance this kind of official statement and the reality on the ground. The reality would be that actually the army would go very strongly after some Boko Haram hideouts on the Lake Chad Islands or on the swamps in Chad, but even abroad. But then I don't think that, you know, a kind of a solid national operation against a group that actually has a regional scope would be the handing solution. Because when they will be assaulted, some will just end up, you know, in the other countries.
President Deby is an elite soldier by training, and he's also the son of a former president who was killed 3 years ago in battle with rebels close to the Libyan border. It seems that Chad prides itself in the strength of its army. So would this attack be quite dispiriting for the population?
In Chad, army has a very specific place, meaning most of the leaders that we have in the country are coming from the military. So we prize our army, and the army is also considered as one of the strongest to their consideration. So having this kind of strong attack with this high death toll, it's something that actually is very bad for the reputation of that army, the reputation of the head of that army, but also a bad impact on the communities.
And that's Remaji Hoinati, a senior researcher for Central Africa and the Lake Chad Basin at the Institute of Security Studies. In 2022, U.S. Customs and Border records showed that around 13,000 African nationals were registered at the U.S.-Mexico border as asylum seekers. By 2023, this figure had quadrupled to 58,000 people. The route to Mexico is long and arduous, but they made it, along with tens of thousands of people from elsewhere and everywhere, creating a fertile battleground for politicians to fight it out for votes. It is one of the biggest bones of contention between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, and could swing the result of the U.S. elections due next week. Thousands of asylum seekers are anxiously awaiting the result. Many of them live in fear of attack, expulsion, and worse. How are they coping with this? Dr. Eve Kaduli is one of those people. He lives in Springfield, Virginia, where he works as a medical technician. He sent a message to the presidential contenders, but we began our conversation with him telling me how and why he left the Democratic Republic of Congo, where he is from. The journey took him 5 years, and he entered via the Mexican border.
I fled my home country because I was in danger. I was born and grew in Bukavu, in South Kivu. Principally, I escaped because I was persecuted and tortured for the government, unfortunately.
And we know from the reporting that we do here on Focus on Africa that the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo is absolutely riven with war and violence and conflict right now. So I respect your wish not to dwell too much on what happened to you there. So tell us, when you left the Democratic Republic of Congo, tell us about, firstly, the difficulties you encountered and then finally reaching America.
I passed through Rwanda. I crossed the border from Bukavu. I went to Goma, which is North Kivu. You know what is going on since decades and until now. I passed to Rwanda in the city of Gisenyi. From there, I did arrangements which allowed me and helped me to go through Cuba in the Caribbean region. From there, I traveled to Ecuador in South America. And from Ecuador, I went to Mexico, where I crossed the border to get in the United States.
How long did this trip take you?
4 years.
4 years. Okay. When was this? What year?
So I crossed the border on July 2019.
So it's imprinted in your mind?
I mean, so it's part of my story, sad or not, but I try my best to remind the best and the bad moments in order to keep my hope positive.
What was the most difficult thing, do you think, that you had to deal with when you were crossing? Not something that would disturb you psychologically or anything like that, but I'm just wondering, because we talk about people who are making this journey. We talk about people, immigrants, migrants, refugees, asylum seekers, but we don't understand, for many people listening, you know, that there's a human person behind that and they experience things. So I'm just wondering if there's a way in which you can bring home to us what the difficulties are.
You know, when you are traumatized, when you are affected, it's not easy to recover, because you cannot expect something when you are not healthy or mentally stable. But we need to challenge with those complex of the life in order to survive. But I think it depends. When you come from a French country, you will face barrier in order to express what you need from this country, for example. The language is a biggest barrier. The second, when you come from Africa and they want to mix your status as a refugee or asylum seeker with those other countries, like South America, you face that challenge. They take you in the same context.
Did you ever lose hope that you would make it into the U.S.? Because I believe you were in a detention centers for 15 months due to a new law that former President Donald Trump had imposed just a week before you arrived at the U.S.-Mexico border.
Exactly. I went through that situation. But as I say, you know what you are looking for and you believe in yourself and the fact. There is a difference that if people do not accept or believe in facts, no matter the time that will take, you will be right in the future. So my hope, my vision, my ambition is to overcome those situations and arrive to succeed at your target.
You've been in the U.S. now for 5 years. What's your status now?
My case is still pending and I continue to fighting for my case.
Do you ever feel like going back to the DRC? Do you want to go back?
I will never dream about that because Congolese authority, politics, they are still playing the same game. Kabila regime, Tshisekedi regime, they are the same and they don't do any change. So I don't even dream to be in Congo in this situation.
That must be difficult to decide to do, right? Because I believe that your father died recently and you were unable to attend his burial. Well, I suppose because of your status mainly, but I'm hearing you say that also you fear for your life. So you have to balance your life and duties to your parents and your family. That must be hard.
I resume my story in a poetry that I call The Shoes of Hope. And in that one, I remember that my grandmother was told me, I prefer to see you far but safe than to be close and lose your life tomorrow. So it's very hard, difficult, but it's better for me to make sure that I'm alive and I'm safe. Even the prayer I will do, have hope that my family, they are alive.
What would you say to the two presidential candidates about somebody like you, you as an individual, not somebody that belongs to a community that does this or that or is accused of doing this or that, just you, Eve? What would you say to them?
I'm not a politician and I don't wish to be politic because politics also all the time they see their interests. I'm talking about human being. I will talk as person who defend the vulnerable as me because I went through that situation. We are victim of the speech all the time, right? But my prayer, as I came here, I need safety. If they give us condition that we will be safe here, you will go to school, you will get the work in order to pay your bills, to reunification your family. That is all. That is my prayer. But when we see the speech, when you see how they try to, you know, it hurt me. It hurt us. We are in fear. We don't know where to go. But I know even they use us, our status, as their speech, defending USA, defending America. But in fact, they don't put us in our condition, right? So that is my prayer and that is my wish.
Thank you very much for sharing part of your story with us and part of the way you live and the adaptations that you have to make. I appreciate it. And I know that it's not easy to talk about these things again and again. So I really, really appreciate you sharing it with Focus on Africa listeners.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Eve Kaduli in Springfield, Virginia. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
The race to become the next president of the United States is on.
We can't drop the pace now.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
Count on the BBC World Service to keep you informed on the latest breaking news, with insight and analysis you can trust.
Immigration, if you look at polls, a top concern for so many U.S. voters.
The issue of the economy reigns supreme for everybody.
For a global perspective on the U.S. election, search for The Global Story, the documentary, and the Global News Podcast, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
If there's anyone among us that thinks that what happens online has no bearing on what happens IRL, they really need to think again. The latest demonstration of this is happening among Somalis around the world. You might not know, but the country's been riven by civil wars since the early 1990s. The antagonists belong to different clans. That battle is going beyond the streets and regions of Somalia onto screens across the globe. It's called the Big Game. What happens is that Somali influencers based around the world take part in clan-based battles via TikTok live streams. It's no video game, this. People spend large sums of money to back influencers from their clan because money is the name of the game, and that can sometimes backfire on them. This is social media, after all. But it's not just about the money. It's got to do with the content of the game. The currency is clan-based insult, for which members of that clan reward the player. And these are not harmless words like you'd find in a Netflix-type roast. Those words strike at the very fragile heart of Somali nationhood and contribute to a toxic environment online. My colleague Bushra Mohammed has been telling me more. Somalis call it big tribal games. What is it and how does it work?
So for Somalis, they call it the big tribal game. And this is because influencers often representing different clans. They mostly live outside Somalia. For them, doing this battle means like hyping up the viewers from their clan for them to send gifts, proving their superiority over the other clan that night.
So how do they hype up their clan? What do they say?
They trade insults. You know, Somalia has a history of clan fighting, and they mention who won in the civil war in 1991. And the money that people spend, you cannot believe. It's really hard to explain for someone who doesn't watch these games.
Who adjudicates whether or not an insult is worth something or whether an insult has landed? Is it the amount of money that comes in because of it?
Yeah, the winner is the person who got the most coins. So these people who are sending the gifts, they spend this money on virtual gifts like lion. Just one lion costs over $400. Will you buy that?
I'm from South Africa. We've got lots of lions. We don't need to buy them.
Yeah, I get that. But for these people to support their clan, they're buying lions worth over $400. There's a universe TikTok. It's a gift that costs more than $500 in real money. On this one, you'll see like on the screen, this one triggers an animation of people having a party.
How do people know that this is going to happen on this night? What happens? The preparations.
They do advertisement. They put the two pictures of the influencers together and then they write the big game. But they basically do 2 months advertisement for the game. We spoke to one of the gifters and she told us what they do is like they have a WhatsApp group. They organize who is paying what. And, you know, they put so-and-so is paying 1,000. So-and-so is paying 10,000. So they...
Dollars?
In dollars.
Wow.
Yeah.
When and how did this start?
It became popular in 2021. And people were talking about it on the TikTok Somali side. They were debating about, like, how this is, like, a good thing. Some women were saying, we will sell our gold to fight for our clan. I know.
You're responding to my look of amazement that people are prepared to do all of that.
Yeah.
So who are the viewers and who are the gifters? These people that are prepared to spend all that money on the honor of their clan over TikTok?
We can say most of the viewers are in the Somali region, like in Somalia, the Somali side of Kenya and Ethiopia and even Djibouti sometimes. For some games, you'll see like more than 100,000 people tuning in. If the game is really big, so many people from the country even will sell their cameras.
They'll sell their gold, and they'll sell their camels.
Yeah.
If there's one thing that Somalis love, it's their camels.
Yeah.
My goodness. Why are they so invested in this, do you think?
Clan is really important in the Somali community. You know, when you are doing wedding, they will fundraise for you. When someone dies, they will help you with anything you need. But most importantly, it's a really sensitive topic. It's because of, like, as I said earlier, it's because of the civil war in 1991, where hundreds of thousands of people have been killed. And, you know, millions of people have fled to the neighboring countries like Kenya and Ethiopia. We spoke to one of the residents in Mogadishu. His name is Saeed, and he's a teacher in Mogadishu. And he's one of the people who's really worried about this kind of event.
I have seen a lot of neighbors who used to live together in a humble way, who used to share plates, are now divided.
Yeah, because it can incite hatred. So tell us about the big rollers, the high spenders.
We spoke to a woman in the United States who says she spends thousands of dollars on the games to support her clan. We will call her Zara, which is not her real name, to protect her identity. What Zara did, she became hooked during COVID-19 lockdowns. And at first, it was like, okay, let me defend my clan. I'll make them win. That is how she started.
To me, personally, it's kind of like just to support the people where I was from, just to give them name.
But it didn't stop there for Zara. She became addicted and she started spending more and more money.
That addiction led her into trouble. She experienced something much worse. Zara was verbally abused and threatened by an influencer.
Imagine your family see your photos in a naked body because they don't know it was AI photos. They don't know it was photoshopped. They find who you are. They grab your family photos, your picture, and they say, I'm going to expose you.
So not just that. Insults, not just the fact that you can lose a lot of money, but also extortion via TikTok.
Let me give you like example. Like when you're sending this money, you're sending a lion. It roars. When you're watching from the screen, that feeling of you sending a lion roaring and the reaction that the influencer gets and he's like, oh, look at Zara. She's sending like money. What a strong woman. She kept sending and sending and sending until she landed into this trouble. We have seen videos of the same man insulting other women. And Zara says verbal abuse is common. The man goes by the name Hussein Kipre online. He's a US-based Somali influencer with a large following. We contacted him to put these allegations to him, but he hasn't replied to our message. Zara believes other women have been threatened in this way, but we haven't seen images photoshopped of Zara or other women shared by him in the public domain.
Did you ask TikTok about this?
Yeah, we reached out to TikTok. They said Hussein Kibria's account that was shared by the BBC have been banned for violating its policies on adult sexual and physical abuse. In a statement, a spokesperson said,
we prioritise the safety of our community with some of the industry's firmest streaming requirements, including specific policies for match content, customizable safety tools for viewers, and only allowing people over 18 to go live or send gifts.
Also, TikTok says they moderate content in over 70 languages, including Somali. They may restrict access to live matches if sensitive topics are presented in an inflammatory manner.
That's quite a lot of things to pile up in just one game. How long do these games go on for?
For one game, they normally do 3 rounds. If a person wins the first round, they need the second round. If the second round, the same person wins, that's the end of the game.
But if it's one each, then they've got to go for the tiebreaker.
Yes. Each round, it's 4 minutes.
So in 4 minutes, literally, they can raise tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
Many, many lions.
Yeah, many lions.
And people can be selling their gold and their camels.
Yeah, that's what they said.
Well, I mean, I'm listening to this and I'm thinking, wow, how concerned is the Somali government about this? Because if you're saying that it can actually dismantle the peace in Somalia, that's what I'm getting from you when you say it's sensitive. Have they spoken to TikTok about it?
The Somali government spoke about the hatred that is being spread online, not only TikTok. TikTok was one of them. They even banned, but because of the Somali system of the governance, the federal government, it wasn't like effective. They have arrested some influencers for the clan incitement. So they are fighting with it, but I'm not sure if they reach out to TikTok about this issue.
That was Bushra Muhammad, and you can hear more on this story on BBC Trending this weekend here on the BBC World Service. And as ever, it's available in podcast form as well. Focus on Africa was pulled together by the heroic efforts of Charles Kidonga in Nairobi. Amy Leibovitz, Kane Peary and Yvette Wagira-Maria were hard at work here in London. The senior journalist in charge of all our efforts was Patricia Whitehorn. Nick Randell was our technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown and we'll talk again next time.
The race to become the next president of the United States is on.
We can't drop the pace now.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
Count on the BBC World Service to keep you informed on the latest breaking news with insight and analysis you can trust.
Immigration, if you look at polls, a top concern for so many U.S. voters.
The issue of the economy reigns supreme for everybody.
For a global perspective on the U.S. election, search for The Global Story, the documentary, and The Global News Podcast, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.